Welcome to Questions in Sustainability, a science-based podcast series that explores programs, people, and ideas in sustainability of food systems. I am Professor Paul Bencelli, and I'm your host today. And I'm very excited to introduce the guest we have on the program today. And I'll do that in just a minute, but I do like to lead in with the following, just to remind people that we appreciate our guests who offer their time and their expertise to questions in sustainability. And of course, the views expressed by our guests, or for that matter, by yours truly, do not necessarily represent those of the University of Kentucky. So once again, this is a guest I'm really, really thrilled to have on the program, and it's, her background and expertise is very much appropriate to our interests on this program, my interests. So I'm going to say a little bit about our guest. And really, we could say many, many things. Her name is Dr. Kim Stackhouse Lawson, and she is the director of the AgNext and a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. It's a beautiful place, by the way, I'm sure you know. I'll tell you what, I'll let Dr. Stackhouse Lawson tell us about AgNext. But before her appointment as a professor of animal science at Colorado State University, she was the director of sustainability for JBS USA, where she was responsible for coordinating the North American sustainability program, inclusive of the company's beef, pork, poultry, case-ready transportation, and branded product business. Prior to that, she was the executive director of global sustainability at the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, where she developed the industry's sustainability program. Very, very cool, very exciting to hear more about that. And Kim received her PhD in animal science from the University of California, Davis, and great campus, and was a postdoctoral fellow at Kansas State University College of Medicine, College of Veterinary Medicine, Beef Cattle Institute. And I could go on. Her publications are very, research publications are very appropriate to the general topic of sustainability, as well as greenhouse gas emissions. Just a fabulous background. So, thank you, Kim, for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I guess what I'd like to do maybe is I want to hear more about AgNext, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background that I haven't touched on that explains your interest in this broad issue of sustainability and animal production.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. So AgNext is a new initiative at Colorado State University, and it sits between the College of Agriculture and the College of Vet Med and Biomedical Sciences. And it's actually a provost initiative. And so the most exciting thing about AgNext is that we are going to be adding an additional 12 tenured faculty in a cluster hire, 13 if you add myself. It's so exciting.
It is.
All focused on developing solutions, sustainable solutions for animal agriculture. And Paul, since your audience may have some experience with academia, I'll just explain a little bit about how the cluster is structured, because it's really unique. And we're really excited to kind of foster this new collaborative type approach. So the way this is going to work, the provost is going to fund half of the cluster hire faculty member's salary, and then a partnering department is going to fund the other half. And so the concept is for these 12 faculty members to extend across the university and serve in roles where there are shared interest in the space of sustainability and animal agriculture across campus. And so we may have, we actually are hoping to hire, for example, eventually a nutritional epidemiologist focused on diet and sustainability. Certainly engineers focused in environmental impact sciences will join the team, and range scientists, grazing system specialists. So really trying to do a good job spanning the huge breadth of sustainability in animal agriculture. So that is just really exciting. And we are excited about bringing that team together so that AgNext and CSU can really be the leader for research in animal and ecosystem health, focused on enhancing profitability of the supply chain, and really focused on serving as a crossroads for producers, industry partners, and researchers to come together to innovate real-time solutions for sustainability in animal agriculture. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of team we're trying to build at CSU. And your second question was, provide a bit more background about me and why I care about this. Yeah. So I grew up on a small ranch in far northern California. And my parents are actually foresters by training. And they both Berkeley grads. And my father has a master's degree in ecosystem, like fire ecology. Wow. So like managing forests with fire. And my mother was the first female forester ever in California. And so I'm rooted, very much my background and who I am is rooted in ecology. And when I was 4 years old, they lost their jobs due to the spotted owl crisis. And so there was sort of, you know, this massive kind of shift away from harvesting timber in our public lands. And the majority of timber in California is in public lands. And there were strong private public partnerships where a private company would harvest those public land trees and then pay, of course, for that resource. Right. So they lost their job when I was four. And subsequently, data has shown that the spotted owl is not actually endangered. And so I guess we, at that time, California also, it was one of the first mega forest fires that happened in California. And my parents were able to buy a small piece of land. It's about 400 acres in Northern California. And we restored it. So even though they had lost their jobs in the timber industry and they were doing different things, sort of related to what, you know, they had their degrees were in, we as a family restored this 400 acres back to timber. And because it was small, we couldn't afford to sort of manage it the way you would commercially. And so my parents explored agroforestry, so using grazing to kind of manage brush. And then we used a lot of fire because of my dad's back to manage brush. And so I guess at a really young age, I just saw the ecosystem and animals interacting in a really positive way. And so when I was in graduate school, San Francisco had their first Meatless Monday campaign Meatless Monday campaign.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, focused on reducing meat consumption in an effort to, you know, curb climate change. Yeah. And it just struck me as counterintuitive, right? Like from my background, I always saw this really unique interaction. And so I started studying it. Mm-hmm. And I'm very passionate about it. I love animals and I love our landscape. And I want them both to exist in a positive way. And so I've dedicated my life to that work.
Well, yeah. I wish, what do we got, about 3 or 4 hours? Because we're not going to be able to cover all my questions. You know, it's...
I also, like you, I love food. Yeah. I love food. Yeah. And I love people connecting to food. Yeah. And so it's sort of taken me on this wild journey.
Yeah, it's been an exciting one, I'm sure. I want to jump into some more of the questions. One of the things I sent you was a paper out of, I think it was Nature, that had a particular figure. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but it I know we're doing a podcast. People can't see the picture, but I'm going to see if I can include it on the homepage for this episode. And basically the way I've looked at that figure so many times, and it keeps I keep coming away with a simple conclusion, and that is that we humans like meat. Now, not everybody, but most people. I mean, as countries get more disposable income, very very steep. There's a very steep decline in terms of how much meat they consume. So I think giving up meat is something some people, it's right for some people, but there's an awful lot of people that want to eat meat, and I'm one of them. So carry on with this important work that you're doing. So AgNext, give us more background on that.
Yeah, so, you know, at AgNext, we are really pulling together this incredible team of scientists to really push forward, right, and to innovate looking forward. So I think, you know, the majority of work that's happened in the sustainability space as it relates to agriculture is what practices were we doing 30 years ago versus today? And how has that changed, right? Our impact on greenhouse gases, potentially water, you know, or it may be social influences. And what we're trying to do at AgNext is actually focus forward. We want to be a team that innovates and really pushes the boundaries of what we know is possible in the animal agriculture space through the lens of sustainability. So we have a unique relationship with our industry stakeholders, and we've actually invited them to be a part of an industry innovation group where we hear from them, and we have this back and forth dialogue around where are the innovation gaps, and as you know, so much research today happens in the private sector. But in this space of sustainability, specifically related to animal agriculture, it is so expensive to do that those strong private public partnerships, academic industry partnerships are absolutely necessary to really drive the transformational change that is needed to save the planet and also needed to sustain the industry, right? Mm-hmm. So it is not a one or another, right? It has to be both. We mm-hmm. have to move this in a way where we limit environmental impact and we also improve supply chain resiliency. We improve producer profitability. We improve rural community structure. We improve diversity, equity, inclusion, mm-hmm. right, in these supply chains. And that is what our industry partners are asking for. And that's where the gap is. So mm-hmm. we're really trying to focus forward. And we're trying to do that in a way that is not myopic. So I think that's really important, right? In this sustainability space, especially right now, climate is the topic of discussion. It's my passion. It's what I research. But in the space mm-hmm. of sustainability, specifically related to animal agriculture, really having a balanced approach of the three pillars of sustainability is so important, right? Yeah. Economic, social, and mm-hmm. environmental. And especially even in that environmental pillar, you know, water is an incredibly important resource, right, to all of us. And soil health and soil quality and biodiversity and, you know, wildlife mm-hmm. habitat and all these things animals interact with, especially in our U.S. Supply chain. And so we are trying to build a team that covers that gamut from animal health, right? So how healthy are these animals? All the way through their interaction with wildlife, their interaction with people, their interaction or their effect potentially on our economy. What about the resiliency of food systems, et cetera? And we're trying to build a team who is respectful enough with each other to drive, to move the needle, right? And to innovate in a way that our supply chain partners are comfortable adopting whatever innovation it is, right? Whether it's a practice, a best practice, a technology, like we're not particularly picky, right? About the innovation that comes out. And it does, right? It could span the gamut of machine learning and does all the way to manure management. And, you know, there's not a lot of teams that are focused on that. There's lots of universities who have somebody who is an expertise in one of those areas. But as you know, mm-hmm. in academic settings, we don't do a great job actually kind of pulling these big multidisciplinary teams together in one university and thinking creatively about what's the next innovation that's really needed. And so we're trying to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that sort of leads into what I'll present to you at the end of the podcast, but I think I mentioned to you prior to recording that I've got a little bit of a surprise for you. And so it relates very much to the pillars of sustainability. And so, and you've already mentioned all three for the benefit of listeners who may be new to the subject of sustainable agriculture. There are three pillars that my organization, the SARE Sustainable Ag Research and Education Program actually promulgates. And one is profitability, economic vitality for rural communities. And second is environmental stewardship. And the third is quality of life. And you've mentioned all three. So that just give us a little more on how, how those pillars relate to the work that you all are doing.
Absolutely. So like your program, they're foundational to ours. We call them out similar to you, right up in our vision statement. So really, really foundational to the work that we do. And, I think it's interesting, as scientists, it's really hard to develop outcomes in research projects and when we develop innovation, where we're tracking multiple things, right? We want to focus on one thing because we're trying to eliminate noise from the question, right? So that we're certain if we apply these treatments, these are the outcomes that actually deliver. And sustainability research and this sustainability question, it forces us to think differently. It asks us to, it begs us for that, right? And it begs us to broaden our perspective and to include even more measurables in our research projects. And simply put, that is how we're approaching it today, right? If we're feeding cattle a feed additive, and I'm picking this because I love it, it's what I do. If we're feeding cattle a feed additive, 10 years ago or 12 years ago when I was in graduate school, all I did was measure methane, CO2, nitrous oxide and animal growth, right? Animal performance to make sure there wasn't an unintended consequence there. Today, I measure animal welfare. I look at how their behavior changes. Today, I measure oxidative stress to try to understand stressors that I may not be picking up in animal behavior, but I can pick up in blood samples. Today I measure phosphorus and nitrogen and manure. I measure the amount of manure. I measure ammonia that's fluxing off of the pens. I of course measure, CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide too, and animal performance, but I might also now measure meat quality. I might follow them all the way into the processing facility and try to understand, okay, how does this treatment have any impact? On the physiology of the animal. So I might actually look at lung scores or heart scores or the insides of that animal's digestive tract to make sure there wasn't any, unintended consequences in terms of health. I'm also going to look at the meat from a consumer's perspective. Do we still have the tenderness we're hoping for? Do we still have the marbling that they expect? There's the system is so much bigger, right, than one myopic answer to one question. And sustainability forces us to think in that way. And I think that, we should all, but all research should be done, right, in this sort of systems type approach. And what we found is that there's a really unique space, and I'm hoping our team plays in it, where we discover something works, a treatment works, right, in a very controlled environment. And then before it goes to the private sector to see, is it really scalable? Can it really be adapted? There's this unique place where unintended consequences and systems get to be evaluated. And it takes a unique group of people, to be able to think about all of that and to orchestrate research projects that don't, if you're answering one question, you're not, you're creating noise in another. So we're hoping to play in that space and are relying on those three pillars and the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Actually, we've got, we're starting to build those into all of our research questions as a way to make sure that, we're cognizant of the globe, right? And we're paying attention to these policy implications. And importantly, we're training students who think like this, and you know, try to view the world at a from a different you know, from a different level. Like mm-hmm. 1,000 people that are trained at the 1,000-foot level is not what scientists usually do, mm-hmm. and so we're trying to balance that.
Yeah, yeah, boy, this is so so interesting to me. So. So you mentioned several parameters and things that you are paying attention to in your in the broader research program and outreach program at AgNext that directly impinge on the social aspects of food production. So let me just give you a chance to highlight one or two or three of those again, because that's something you know, I don't know if my colleagues will agree, but I think that, you know, in a career of 30 something years as a faculty member, I realize that as a plant pathologist, I realize I've done very well in the natural sciences area and the profitability pillar, but really not, I don't think about them.
It's very difficult. Yeah, it's very difficult. So similar to your work, right? In the field of animals, people are making decisions about animals, just like they're making decisions about crops or, right? People are really making these decisions. And what we find in the social realm of animal science is that they, just like everywhere, there's those individuals who are making those decisions are not driven by just profitability, right? It's really fascinating. They don't respond necessarily to a dollar amount. And there's a couple of reasons for this. First is the nature of the supply chain. So let me give you an example. In the beef industry in the United States today, we have approximately 750,000 ranchers, and the average herd size is 38 head. Okay, so these people, they're not large. They're also not doing this for a living, right? They may own cows because they think they're pretty and they need a lawnmower. I mean, really, right? And it's a hobby for them. And so we have this really interesting supply chain here in the United States that is not necessarily sensitive to market demand drivers. And so our ability to influence the decisions that they are making as we're used to doing in a capitalist, you know, society, it's just not congruent all the time. The other interesting thing about, we'll just stay with beef because we already talked about them, but it's largely across most of our extensive livestock systems, is that they're very driven by culture. So their family has done this for this many generations, and it is a way of life. I mean, it is not just my grandfather did it. This is a part of my identity, and it is who I am. And so one of the technologies I am most excited about to improve people's lives, but also from a sustainability perspective, a natural sciences perspective, is virtual fence. So we actually have the ability now to put collars on cows, and it's just like a virtual fence for a dog, right? So they wear a collar, and you have in the pet setting, you bury the cord, and it's an invisible fence. Okay. You bury the cord, and as the dog gets closer, it beeps, right? And then if the dog gets too close, it gets a shock, and if it gets closer, it gets a bigger shock. In the cattle world, we now have the ability to collar these animals and draw virtual fence lines on our phones. And it's awesome. And it's awesome because we know a lot about the animal. We know how much they're lying down. So we can detect health. Like if they get sick, we can actually figure it out faster. We can move them. This is really exciting from a climate perspective. So we can move them to higher quality forages as they're growing and reduce methane potentially. We haven't actually proven that, but we've got some trials running this summer where we're going to try. We can keep them out of riparian areas, right? We can keep them out of nesting bird areas. So habitat where we know birds are nesting and grazing is not good during that nesting period. We can now, without labor and, you know, fence and all of these costs and time and all these things that these ranchers may not have time to do, we can now just do it on our phones. Now, you would think this would be easy to adopt. You would think ranchers would be so excited about this, but they want to go step on their horse.
What do you mean step on their
horse? Step on their horse to move cattle. They don't want to do it from a phone. Uh-huh. They want to go get on their horse. They want to go be with their family when they do this. They want to go, it is who they are. It is in their identity, right? And it's beautiful, right? It's beautiful. That's a wonderful attribute. And it's so challenging. Yeah. Like this social aspect is so challenging. Yeah. And really understanding those social dynamics is something we don't understand enough, right? I mean, we haven't had enough social scientists working on this. We haven't solved solutions. Like we haven't developed solutions through the lens of community for very long. I mean, lots of talk about that now, but we're not good at it yet. So I think there's so much potential in that space. And I think it's going to be really challenging. Technology is going to be something that is going to be interesting to watch as we see these communities become more, you know, comfortable with it. Yeah,
well, this is really all very exciting. I'm enjoying very much hearing about it, Kim. So let's take a short break, and just a very, very short, maybe it'll be in a minute or so, but it's just a musical interlude to sort of allow the listeners to refresh. And when we come back, folks, we're speaking with Dr. Kim Stackhouse Lawson, professor of animal science at Colorado State University, and also the director of the AgNext program at Colorado State. And she's talking about sustainability and livestock production. So we look forward to hearing more. We'll be right back. We're back. This is Paul Vincelli from the University of Kentucky. I'm your host for our podcast series, Questions in Sustainability. And we're speaking today with Dr. Kim Stackhouse Lawson, professor of animal science at Colorado State University, and also the director of the AgNext program, which sounds quite exciting. We talked at length about that in the first part of the program. And so now I kind of want to move to, you know, some of the really sort of nuts and bolts practical challenges or goals that we have here. And one is, Kim, is one question is, how can we produce the people want beef? Okay. And so that's become very clear to me over my lifetime. So the question that that I have is, how can we produce the beef people want, but with major reductions in greenhouse gases?
Yeah, that's the $1 million question, Paul, I wish I knew the answer to. I would be a millionaire. So I think first let's talk about what greenhouse gases beef emit. So the biggest and most difficult to affect in terms of actually reducing it is methane. So if you think about the whole footprint of the animal, about 65 to 70% of that footprint is comprised of methane. And the reason the animals produce methane, they actually respire it. So they burp methane, and cattle have a stomach that has four compartments, four chambers. And the reason they are able to convert grass to the beef we love to eat is because the digestion of that grass takes place in what's called a rumen. And that rumen is full of microorganisms that digest the grass and turn it into the nutrients that the animal needs. Okay. And it's actually, I mean, it's much more complicated than that, but that's a high level. So interestingly, the longer the carbohydrate chain, okay, so the longer the fiber is, the more methanogens that exist in that rumen. And the methanogens are what produce the methane. So it is actually her biological, and I'm saying her because my next fact point will probably surprise folks, but her biological physiology is what produces the methane. And it's the other really cool thing, right? It's also the reason she can produce food, this cow can produce food in places where nothing else will grow, right? It's both good and bad, right? Yeah, so we have to, again, kind of consider how do we reduce the methanogen population without hurting her, right? Like actually negatively impacting her health or making her less able to utilize these extensive landscapes where we don't grow food anyway, right? Because we all know we have a growing population. We're going to need all the land mass that we have, and not all of it is suitable for crop production where we might get, you know, other sources of protein. So the other thing that I think is really important to understand is where the majority of the greenhouse gases come from. So when you think about the beef supply chain, there's the ranch, and then there's usually other steps in between this, but we'll simplify it. There's the ranch. That animal weans a calf. It goes into a stalker phase where the animal continues to be out on grass and grow. And when that animal is about a year to 14 months old, 15 months old, it is transitioned into a feedlot. And the feedlot phase is where they're given the grain diet, a higher percentage grain diet. The majority of the greenhouse gases, 65% of the carbon footprint of beef, happens on the ranch.
Okay.
Not in the feedlot. And the reason for that is a couple reasons. First, it's her diet, remember? So she's the one that's eating the long chain grasses. And in the feedlot, we can reduce methane by about 50% just because we change the diet. Just because it's more, the bugs shift and the bugs become more efficient. Okay, that the microorganisms become more efficient in their digestive processes. The other reason is because the cow has bulls, right, that she's supporting, or as we think about the footprint, right, we're dividing by the amount that system is producing. So the cow exists on the ranch. 15% of a replacement exists on the ranch. So 15% of young cows, heifers exist on the ranch, and bulls exist on the ranch, right? So there's, it's twofold. It's one, she's producing a lot of methane there, and two, that's the factory. Okay. That's the factory. So how do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions? So this will also surprise you. Up until 4 years ago, we could not even measure greenhouse gas emissions from animals in their natural environment. We had to put them in chambers, right? In full animal chambers, like in rooms.
Enclosed.
Or we had to make respiration chambers just where their heads would go in, or we had to put them in big bubbles. But every time you do that, their intake goes down.
Yeah, because they're uncomfortable, basically, right?
They're uncomfortable. That's not their natural environment. That's right. So most recently, about 4 years ago, their technology was developed where we now have what's called the green feed unit, and the animal is baited. So we give them a treat and it sticks their nose in there and takes the treat, and we measure a little bit of methane. So if we measure an animal over a month's period of time, we feel confident in that animal's emission profile. But you can only measure 24 animals at a time on one of these green feeds. So if you think about the producer we just talked about, they're amazing and they do an incredible job managing the natural resources within their environment, but they've got challenges, right? Their way of life is not profitable all the time. And you can imagine how they might feel if we're suggesting they feed an animal something to reduce methane, but we've only tested it on a very small number of animals. So there's this really interesting challenge in between we know it works and the scalability of it. The other interesting challenge is methane is a loss of energy for the animal. So we as animal scientists have been working on reducing methane for hundreds of years because it would be a gain in performance for the animal. So today we think about it all through the lens of greenhouse gases, but we have thought about it for a very long time. And influencing the microorganisms in that rumen is hard. As you know, microorganisms adapt, right? So we can even feed them something and we might get methane reductions for 30 days. And then the microbial population adapts and then methane goes back up, right? Because it is who she is as a cow. So it's why I love to study it, right? It's wickedly complex. There's all of these different facets. Tons of people think about it. So ruminant nutritionists think about it. I'm more of a stress physiologist. I think about it. Like there's all these different lenses. You could think about it. Like we plant pathologists think about it. How do we get tannins to grow, for example, in the extensive arid West? Because we know tannins can reduce methane emissions, but we need the cow to eat tannins. I mean, how do we do this? And so will we do it? I have no doubt. I have no doubt we will figure it out. And this will also probably surprise you. There has not been a significant amount of federal funding in this space since 2010. So we're starting to see that funding come back. I think that's really going to help. And I think we will figure it out. Industry is so excited to figure it out too, right? Our producer partners want a solution. Like they are worried about climate change. It's going to impact them before it's going to impact, you know, many of us in terms of their adaptive capacity. They want to meet our consumers where they're at, and they're excited about solutions, but those solutions have to be scalable. And we have to know that it's not going to hurt the animal, right, from a health and welfare perspective, and that it's not going to further burden them from a profitability standpoint. We have to know. And it has to be practical to implement, right? That, like, how do we get them to change this attribute? So it's a really complex question. It's really exciting. It's a really exciting space right now. And I'm super, super positive and confident that we'll figure out something. We just don't have a something yet. We have a lot of somethings that are really close. But no silver bullet.
Yeah, Kim, wow. I just got a million questions here. And one that is, I don't know if it makes sense based on what you said, so I may have misinterpreted or not followed the logic completely, but I'm thinking about the grass-fed versus feedlot-fed beef. And so you know that issue quite well and know that there are those that are critical of feedlots. But is there, and I've been told by experts that there's a cost, a greenhouse gas emission cost to grass-fed beef. Can you help us understand issue?
Sure. So I think I'll start with just I'm also very passionate to not make a villain of anybody who's raising our food, right? So I also think I'm also very passionate about consumers having choice, right? So if a consumer feels better about consuming grass-fed beef over grain-fed or vice versa, they should feel great about making either of those choices. Okay. But to really answer your question, first, it's really important to understand that all beef in the US is grass-fed for some portion of their life, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, remember, we have those 750,000 ranchers, and all of those animals are on grass. All the mother cows, all the bulls, all the heifers, and their offspring until they're 6 to 7 months old when they're weaned. Once that animal's weaned, typically they go to a stocker operation, and that stocker operator will either be in extensive rangelands or they'll be in small grains. Right, so you'll see animals grazing this time of year on winter wheat potentially, or on stover, right, that's left over in the field, or those sorts of things. So those are oftentimes animals that are weaned and are sort of in a I call it the teenage years, right? Where they're like putting on that skeletal growth. At that point in the supply chain, the majority of beef in the US, probably 98%, head to a feed yard. So they head there when they're 14 to 15 months old, and they are in a feed yard for 180 to 190 days, typically in the Midwest. If you're in California, or in a place where it's more expensive to get corn or grains too, they might only live in a feed yard for 90 to 100 days, right? So it just kind of depends on the market conditions. This another percentage might be grass finished. Okay, so that means that they go through the stocker phase and then they're finished on grass. And in some systems, they're finished on more extensive kind of rangelands. And on other systems, they're finished in intensive grazing systems where the producer may plant a forage variety to improve the carcass quality, i.e. add more fat, right, to that animal, because the U.S. consumers, that's one of the things we love about beef, right? So those producers are very sensitive to consumer sentiment, right? It's just the nature of that particular market. So to answer your question about greenhouse gases, if we only look through the lens of climate, our traditional beef system has a lower carbon footprint. They are more carbon efficient. And if you are only worried about greenhouse gas emissions, that system is more efficient, even when you include feed and even when you include carbon sequestration from that grass finished animal. Now, I started with, I don't want to make a villain of anyone, right, and I want consumers to feel great about every choice that they make. So there's attributes to both systems, right? And there's good and bad attributes, like, and not even bad, right? There's challenging, like these producers have different challenges. And I think, you know, that's something that we miss sometimes. I would say as scientists, but also as society, right? We so much want a silver bullet approach, right? Like there's this problem and figure out the answer. And in agriculture, and especially animal agriculture, silver bullets don't exist, right? We raise cattle in Montana, and we raise them in Florida, and we raise them in Arizona, and we raise them in the, you know, in New York. And those ecosystems are so different. Like what's going to work just in one place in the United States may not work in another place. And if you expand that to the globe, right, it might be the opposite of what you should do. And so we have to develop solutions that are place-based. It's more of a silver buckshot approach, right? And we, I think we've got to get as a group of people, like if we're really going to feed this growing population, we've got to get flexible on our ability to develop solutions, but also to accept different ways of raising food, right? Because you know this, right? I mean, just the differences in plants, right? Just because of environmental attributes, right? Those plants affect our cattle. And I mean, you know, everything is connected. So great questions. One of my favorite ones to answer. Yeah. So I'm glad you did. And it's a really exciting space. And I'm a big believer that grain-fed and grass-fed beef is sustainable and can be more sustainable, right? Mm. That there's still great, great innovation to take place and to make the systems better.
Yeah. So one more question that, you know, that it's sort of pressing enough to bring into this conversation. I think about producers and, you know, and I think producers of, you know, you name it, particular way of producing cattle or, you know, particular way of producing crops. There's somebody out there that doesn't, you know, like what that producer might be doing. And I feel like it must be hard on producers to because they, you know, they have an ethic of caring for the land and caring for those in the community and beyond. And so I think it must be hard to have to listen to some of those debates and respond productively. What's been your experience on this issue?
Yeah. And, you know, the producers I know best are beef producers. And that came from my time when I actually developed their very first sustainability program. And it was a really interesting experience. It was my first job too. So I was really young. Hate is a strong word, but it was very hard. It was very hard. And it came from such a good place. You know, you said it, like they care so much, and they're so proud of what they do. And to them, they provide food to the masses, yes. Right? And they take care of their landscape, and that landscape it's who they are. It's a part of them, right? It's their identity. And they love their cattle. And they felt very attacked. Mm-hmm. 15 years ago when I started that program, mm-hmm. for them. And it was really hard. It was really hard for them to, and it, again, not ill intention. They're wonderful people. Mm-hmm. But today is so different, right? Today, they're pushing me, go faster, develop solutions that are better. When our industry innovation group was helping us shape what AgNext could be, and they said, we don't want you to look backwards. We want you to focus forward. Yeah. We want you to innovate. And I told them, I said, then I need you to be comfortable with a team that fails 90% of the time. Because, or 98% of the time, right? Because that's what innovators do. We fail. Mm. We fail again, and you get up and you fail again. Mm. And the majority of our producers are there, right? They are ready to implement transformational change, but they want it to be real. They want it, and they want to see the data. And I'm sure you experience that, right? With farmers, like they are data driven. Individuals. And so that's the hard part of sustainability is the emotional aspect, yeah. of it, right? When emotion and science don't line up, that's now what I think beef producers struggle with the most. But they're pushing us so hard. Yeah. I mean, they are what's keeping me up at night, is that, yeah. I feel like they don't feel like we're delivering at a pace that's fast.
They
enough.
Want, yeah. Yeah.
That they want.
Yeah. Actually, and you know, thanks for reminding me. I had it in my notes, but I forgot to do it. I wanted to start the program by saying thank you to the producers who are listening and those that serve the producers, because you all feed my family. So I wanted to.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I agree. They're some of my favorite people.
So maybe we'll just ask if there's anything we have not covered that we should before we wrap it up.
Oh, well, we could go on,
yes.
for hours.
I'm convinced.
but I've absolutely enjoyed the conversation and your balanced and respectful approach. And I'm so thankful that you host a podcast to share about sustainability and food. And it's something I'm extraordinarily passionate about. So thank you for your work.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. So, we're not going to sign off just yet. I mentioned I had a surprise for you, so I'm going to, yes. introduce that. Yeah. So because of my recognition that as a natural scientist, I and maybe some of my colleagues, many of my colleagues in the natural sciences have maybe not given enough attention over the years to the quality of life dimension and the social dimension of sustainable ag. We're interested in that, but we get this sort of tunnel vision to do the great work we do in profitability and environmental stewardship. But so in order to recognize and affirm the role of quality of life as a pillar in sustainability, I introduce a piece of music at the end of every podcast. I started doing that with the most recent podcast. And so so excited to show you what I came up with for this particular program. It's a I'm gonna have to find it here, find the files, but they are ancient herding calls from Scandinavia.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And so, awesome. Yeah, so these are sung very short. So we're gonna, yeah. just go through them really quickly.
And I don't know if you've done a podcast, but I'll plug one for you, yeah. on pastoralism. you might consider it. And we actually have a phenomenal expert here who we could put you in touch with.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that'd be a nice follow-up.
Yes, yeah. So perfect, yeah. And very, very special. So thank you. Thank you for that acknowledgement.
So folks, we're going to close here by and then play those two Scandinavian herding calls that I obtained for this very podcast, and stay tuned and for those. And Kim, thanks once again for joining us. I'm really thrilled that you were able to and share your knowledge and expertise and your passion.
Thank you.
So we've been speaking with Dr. Kim Stackhouse Lawson from Colorado State University. It's been a pleasure, Kim. Thanks very much. And stay tuned. Here are the two herding calls, and folks, we'll hope you join us next time. So those were two ancient herding calls from Scandinavia. My name is Paul Vincelli. I'm from the University of Kentucky, and this is Questions in Sustainability.